topic tonight is, can a citizen intelligently criticize his nation's foreign policy? Can he intelligently criticize? I don't know whether you've thought about this, but that's a problem. There are a lot of scholars. I suspect the majority of scholars in the field of international diplomacy who would feel very strongly that citizens cannot intelligently criticize their nation's foreign policy for reasons that I want to try to make clear tonight. And then I want to get into the question, well, then what do we do? Is there anything? Because some of us feel frustrated by this. But this question is posed, the answer, and I pose it very often to groups of all sorts, and I'll tell you this too. Don't be browbeaten by me tonight. I've never yet walked out of a discussion on this topic where I felt the majority was on my side. The hawks and the doves, and the people on both sides are quite convinced that they can intelligently criticize foreign policy. But when the question is asked, people come back with, well, this is a democracy. Citizens have the right and the duty to criticize. Well, yeah, that establishes the problem. suppose they do have the right and duty, can they intelligently criticize? The problem remains, the question remains. Well, people come back, this is the second most popular answer I get. Well, shouldn't the citizens of Germany have protested against Hitler's foreign policy? And that, again, only establishes that we have got a problem. The real question is, how could the citizen of Germany have known early enough that it was his duty to protest Hitler's foreign policy? Well, by 1944, it was pretty easy to see that Hitler was leading the German nation down a suicidal path. But could you have intelligently criticized Hitler's foreign policy? I'm talking about his foreign policy at the time that he took over part of Czechoslovakia, or at the time of the Anschluss with Austria, or when he made his defensive move against France. At what point? And looking back now, we can say it was demonic and horrible. Every Christian and sensible man should have stood up and protested. But did the German citizen, at any time when he was still capable of effectively making point, a critical point, did he really have the information that would have permitted him to be so intelligently? Your unintelligent criticism is useless, or worse. And you might remember, too, that hindsight is not a useful kind of sight. Now, I want to, again, put that word intelligently in capitals, because nothing I say tonight should be interpreted as telling you that you have no right to criticize your government's foreign policy. I think that most criticisms of the government's foreign policy are foolish. And I also think that in their net effect, and I'll get all my heresies right out on the table in the beginning, the net effect of vigorous public discussion of foreign policy is disastrous. That if we had to choose between no public discussion of foreign policy, no citizen knowledge even of what the government is doing in foreign policy, and vigorous and spirited public discussion, I would, without a moment's hesitation, choose the former. Maybe you will see why as I proceed. Now, if the problem is intelligence, and the word intelligence has a double meaning. Intelligence means, you know, the government has an intelligence department, and it talks about getting intelligence. That means information. So that's one thing intelligence means, but intelligence also means reasoning power. So when I ask whether we can intelligently criticize the government's foreign policy, I'm asking two questions. Do we have the reasoning power, the intellectual ability to criticize, but more importantly, here's the problem, do we have the information that would enable us to criticize? The peculiar problem of foreign policy in a democracy is this, that foreign policy is conducted in a sort of game strategy situation. Now, when I say game strategy, I'm not suggesting these are light issues and that it's as frivolous as a game of poker or something, but this is the context in which diplomacy occurs. To win, you must keep your enemy from knowing your real situation, including how far you're willing to go, what cost you will incur, what risks you're prepared to take, which of your demands are highly negotiable and which reflect vital interests that you will not surrender except at the cost of a bitter fight. Where your relative strengths and weaknesses are. And, of course, another thing you want to conceal from him is what you know about all of this about him. Now, anyone assessing a particular foreign policy decision of his government in ignorance of all of these facts of the situation probably assesses unintelligently. We can misunderstand the point and lose its impact by setting up straw man examples. So we could all say, without any kind of special information, that the United States government should not atom bomb Peru when the Peruvian government seizes some of our fishing vessels. And we could all say that the United States government, even without any kind of information, that the United States government should declare war if the Chinese land 14 divisions on Long Beach. But the real issues come in between. The real issues involve the sending of a few more troops in here, the exerting of some additional pressure on this government, the use of CIA techniques to try to influence foreign capital, these sorts of things, where these citizens do not know the situation, do not know what is going on, what the relative strengths and weaknesses of the two parties are, how this game is being played. And we cannot, of course, rely on our government to give us the information. Because if the government gives us the information, it gives the enemy the information. Also, a point that's been neglected in all of our discussion of the credibility gap is that no government can ever be trusted to supply its citizens with information that could call into question that government's own policy. I mean, I think it's just naive to expect the government to. I don't expect the president of a corporation to supply me as a stockholder with information that I could use to call into question his policies. And he's not going to do it. And it's not necessarily strange, and that's not evidence of the duplicity of government officials. I mean, have you ever been in a situation where you had to present you were called upon to present both sides, but you felt very strongly committed to one side? I mean, how did it come out? All of the facts supporting the side to which you were committed come out with vigor and force, and those arguments are presented in a loud, clear voice. And then you say, but now we must present the other side. Well, there is a case, perhaps, that can be made. Somebody spot out some pretty weak arguments. It's not that you're trying to fool them. It's just you're presenting the truth as you see it. The government obviously believes in its policies, or it wouldn't be practicing them. So it's not going to say, now, citizens, here's all kinds of information that you may think is very, very important, but we didn't think was important at all, which is why we didn't act on the basis of it. It's just not going to work out that way. The myth of disinterested impartiality is one that you should be very careful of. I tell this story a lot, but it illustrates something. My pastor in a little congregation in Valparaiso, Indiana. We were at the congregation having a big fight over whether we should put kneelers in. And we would have a big congregational meeting at which we were going to settle this in the spirit of Christian brotherhood, and completely open, and the pastor said, I will open with a prayer, and then we will settle it in the spirit of Christian brotherhood. In his prayer, he asked that God would grant us today, God would give us faith so that we would not be too proud to fall on our knees before him.
And this man,
this man is utterly without guile. He didn't have a deceitful bone in his body. He knew the Lord wanted to find me. The congregation loved him so much that they wouldn't deny him what he wanted. But there's, I'm sure there's still people who knew on that congregation with a scowl. let's take the very thorny business of the Cambodian invasion. Maybe you have argued with your neighbors or with some of your friends about that, for or against. Let's suppose that you argued for. Let's suppose that you, along with most Americans, supported the president in what he did. The Cambodian?
Yeah.
Well, the question is, should the government have gone in there and gone into Cambodia or not? Okay. Well, yeah, here we go. Here we go. Yeah, but you say it's just a line in the jungle, and is it just a line? The point is, that, and I don't want to argue it out here, but to argue for it is going to involve you in judgment concerning the significance of borders, troop positions, supply lines, military intentions, withdrawal procedures, and all sorts of complicated questions of military tactics. Also, it's going to involve you in questions of what was the Cambodian government really doing and what kind of influence did the U.S. government have in the overthrow of Sihanouk. And you're going to be making judgments on all sorts of very, very complicated, some extremely technical questions. That is how Nixon argued for it. He argued for his position on the basis of information that he said he had, which he had gotten from competent experts in the field on the spot, and he arrived at a difficult decision after assessing all of this information, and we don't have as much information as he has. If you want to argue for or against it, now stress it, for or against, you're really at a loss. And that's why these arguments prove so pointless. You know, have you ever seen anybody in recent years arguing anything connected with the Vietnam War which they reached an agreement? I mean, everyone goes away completely convinced still, because the facts that we need to decide just aren't available to us. So what it seems to come down to is, how can you counter the president? The president is in a position to have better intelligence than anybody else. He's not only got access to all sorts of information to which we do not have access, but he also has a lot of highly trained specialists working for him and giving him advice. And who of us is in any kind of a position to say, you're wrong? We can't counter him on his own ground, because he's got the technical information we don't have. So it almost seems, and I come to a suggestion that I want to throw it out baldly and then later back slowly away from it. You've got to trust the president. And that is the first thing I'm afraid that one has to say in any country. When it comes to foreign policy, you've got to cross your fingers, pray to God, and hope that you've got a rational man in the executive. He's in charge. And the thing I like most, and say about the only thing I liked about President Nixon's speech in defense of Cambodia, was his statement several times, I made this decision. I'm responsible for it. I like that. He is in charge by a close but legal election, and only one person can be in ultimate charge. Congress cannot make foreign policy. Boy, you know, I'm rooting for all those guys. I mean, all my favorite senators are dumb. But I wonder if the liberals remember that it wasn't too many years ago when the liberals were yelling that Congress cannot make foreign policy in the days of the Bricker Amendment. Then the conservatives were trying to tie the president's hands. And the argument is still valid. The Senate isn't capable of making foreign policy. But now, there was a lot of people here, and I don't know how many of you are pro-Nixon or how many of you are against him, but the problem is that a lot of Americans, and a growing number of Americans, simply do not trust President Nixon. And I want to get into that. A lot of people came to distrust President Johnson. Let's just worry about the distrust of Nixon. If you want to go back further, we might remember how many people thoroughly distrusted President Clinton. in his foreon policy views, how many people, though they were on the other side this time, thought that Truman was always telling us out to the comedy. it is quite possible that Truman could not end the Korean War if he caused the nation's destruction in some template. But if you take a hard, I think it is, if you are one of those people who intensely distrust President Nixon, I would urge you to examine your motives. And I don't do that here. I know myself, and I have to be continually aware of this, that I don't like Nixon's style. You know, I find the man somewhat evasive in manner. I like someone who is blunt and is always making unguarded remarks. And I kind of like Spiro Agnew's style. and Nixon is, if you understand, and so you see, so this, and this is a highly subjective film, and I've got to watch it and discount for it all the time. But I think a lot of people will be opposed to anything that Nixon says or does just because Nixon said or did it, and that's an extremely dangerous situation for a nation to get into. But there are other reasons why we distrust his conduct of foreign policy. And I want to take up one that I think is most important for me now. And it becomes the anti-conservative stuff, right? Up till now, I've been, I think, giving aid and comfort to the defenders of the administration. And I do, I'm not going to abandon anything I've said. But there is a reason that any thinking American can have, without being accused of mere prejudice, intelligence in the other sense of reasoning power. Put it very simply, the touchstone of foreign policy must be the national interest. There just is no other touchstone for foreign policy. And Nixon has, in his speeches in the last year, given some pretty clear indications that this is not the ultimate criterion of our government's policy in Southeast Asia. And if it is not, then I say he is guilty of a failure of intelligence. He is not reasoning clearly. He is letting something run away with his sense. Now, why do I say this? Maybe you want to argue that national interest should not be the touchstone of policy. We have to discuss that. Nixon has leaned very heavily in recent months on two arguments that I think betray serious intellectual confusion, and he has failed to respond to a third argument that's valid in principle, but seems by his silence to be invalid in fact. In other words, when people have criticized the statement, which has to do with the threat of Russian Chinese imperialism, when people have suggested that these worldwide revolutions are not Russia and China advancing, he has not answered. But let me take the first two arguments that I think just betray intellectual confusion. One is the humiliation argument, which he reverts to frequently. He's told us now, remember you recall the Cambodian speech, he said, I will not be the first president in the history of the United States to preside over an American defeat. That is no reason for continuing a war. That is no rational reason for continuing a war. War is not a football game. War is a deadly serious business in which people get killed. If the United States is humiliated by defeat in the Vietnam War, that's Nixon's fault because he's got the power to make the right noises and get us out of there without our feeling humiliated. Now, it is a problem, you know, when the people of a nation have too much to say about foreign policy and get too committed to it. And then they are told, you lost, and their noses are rubbed in the fact that they lost. That creates serious morale problems and it makes it difficult for a president. But Nixon doesn't have to do that. Nixon got the power to withdraw us from Vietnam if he wants to and let us think that we weren't humiliated and weren't defeated. And if he doesn't know that, somebody better tell him. And the president has tremendous, we don't know what he's doing over there. That's to come back to this point again. He can withdraw and make all sorts of noises and blame the South Vietnamese and say, we did our part now. And you can paper this all over. Now, this sounds very cynical, I know, but the nation will not have to know it's been humiliated, except for a few people who all think we're being humiliated, if the president does his job properly. And think of the Pueblo incident. That was pretty well handled. Now, a lot of people thought we were humiliated, but I think the government could have used a little more fall to roll and even covered up that feeling of humiliation. The government has to do this. It has to enable its citizens to feel some kind of pride in the nation, unfortunately, because nationalism, patriotic fervor is an unfortunate fact of life, a kind of irrational patriotism. But to use that irrational patriotism as an excuse for policy making is utterly inexcusable. The other argument that Nixon has been using is the freedom and democracy argument. I mean, that we are fighting there in order to preserve freedom and democracy for the people of Southeast Asia. Now, our national interest in no way requires us to defend freedom and democracy anywhere in the world, much less everywhere in the world. And it is no reason, and Nixon knows this, I'm sure he knows it, it is no reason for us to intervene militarily in a country that they have ceased to be free and democratic. This is what Senator Fulbright was talking about basically when he began complaining about the arrogance of power. The notion that because we are powerful, we are capable of imposing our will, our way of life, our preferred political and economic norms upon the entire world. Now, if President Nixon is making foreign policy with some kind of messianic goal like this as the touchstone of policy, then I say he is guilty of a failure of intelligence in the sense of reasoning power. The third argument, which he's been using, which is valid in principle, but I wonder about its validity in fact, is that these revolutions are Russian or Chinese expansionist ventures. The United States today, to preserve its security in the world, must continually check Russian-Chinese power. Okay, that's a valid argument in principle. But now, many critics have maintained that, for example, Vietnam is in no way a pawn of China, that Chinese power will in no way be enhanced through a complete Vietnamese victory, a North Vietnamese victory, and these critics have not been answered by the administration. They have not been answered to my knowledge. I may have missed something. And there are a lot of scholars writing in other places than the Berkeley Barb who are suggesting on the basis of careful analysis that, well, for one thing, not only is it, well, I'm going to get too many negatives in here, I'll turn around. They are telling us that every time there is a revolution, radical revolution using socialist communist rhetoric, that does not add strength to the socialist camp or the Soviet Chinese camp. It may add one country to the socialist camp, but that doesn't increase the strength of that camp. Isn't it true that many of the United States' allies are more embarrassments and impediments than they are help? And that is certainly true also for Russia and China. There is such a thing as indigestion. And there are lots of countries, very, very poor countries. Well, as I've often said, and I still think it's true, that Russia would be secretly delighted if Cuba were to sink a few feet beneath the Gulf of Mexico. It's a tremendous burden on the Russian economy. What do they get out of it? But they can't let them down. They're members of the socialist camp, They got to keep dumping all those rubles into Cuba every year. I very seriously feel that one of the smartest things we could do is let the Russians establish a sphere of influence in a few more countries and begin having all the troubles that we have. But anyway, Nixon has not spoken to this reply to his argument. Well, so, I come toward the end and we can begin talking. I hope I haven't been too confusing. The answer to the question, can a citizen intelligently criticize his nation's foreign policy? In one sense, no. We don't have the information. It's a tragic, maybe, fact of life, but we got to lean back and pray for the president and all that are in authority. They got to calculate the costs and the benefits and act. But, in another sense, we can, because if we agree, if we recognize, I don't care, anyone cannot agree, that the only criterion for foreign policy could finally be the national interest, the very limited criterion, which keeps nations from engaging in all kinds of wild adventures, which keeps foreign policy rational, which keeps it related to cost-benefit analysis. If we then find that our government is wandering off with delusions of omnipotence, fighting various kinds of crusades and, preserving American influence in the world or something like that, or talking about war as if it's a football game, then we can intelligently criticize, not because the government doesn't have good information, we have better, but because somebody in the government isn't thinking. But I want to say before quitting that I cannot buy the criticism that the Vietnam War is immoral. And I think we have done a lot of damage to our national life by saying, insisting that the Vietnam War is an immoral war. National wars cannot be immoral. And they cannot be immoral because they cannot be moral. There is no moral war, and therefore there's no immoral war. Wars are always evil. War is a terrible thing, though war can sometimes be the lesser evil. But they are not immoral. The actions of collectivities can never properly be spoken of as moral or immoral. And the right category for condemning a war is always stupid. A bad war is not an immoral war, it is a stupid war. And a stupid war is a war that inflicts cost beyond the range of probable benefits. And such a war should be condemned by cost-benefit analysts, not by moral theologians. My critique of the Nixon administration is just this, that it gives evidence in its own speeches, testifying against itself, that it is not applying the yardstick of cost-benefit analysis to our Southeast Asian military commitment. But if the Nixon administration gives evidence that it is returning to this rational yardstick, I, for one, shall still be terribly unhappy about Southeast Asia, but I shall not be able intelligently to criticize.
Well, one thing that we're getting
into
the discussion, that is, you said we can't define foreign policy, and that
intelligently. I got a long page here, one page here, two pages here.
But,
Yes, I do. I will say it. The president defines the national interest. Right. He is the only person in a position to do so. Now, that isn't as bad as you think. Now, I know, you see, a lot of people, what we do is we immediately compare that with a domestic situation. We say, we can't trust the president to define the national welfare in terms of domestic policy. And the answer is, no, we can't. Because domestic policy is a matter of dividing up benefits and inflicting burdens on one another. But you see, it is possible
for a man who's in charge of the whole nation vis-a-vis the outside world, to simply assess all impacts out and in terms of their net effect on that entity. Maybe an example. I've never even gotten this across to my wife, maybe I'm confused. But let me try it this way. Suppose that in Guatemala, I'll just make up the name of the country, Guatemala, a group of restless natives with communist ideology seize the plantations of the United Fruit Company. Just make up another name. The United Fruit Company is based in the United States. And so, let's say their executives go to Washington and they say, hey, they've seized our property. That's American property. What are you going to do about it? Now, what they want, you see, is for the U.S. to go in there and take their chestnuts out of the fire. That's clearly in their interest. But somebody else is going to have to pay the costs of that war and going to have to go over there and die. And it's not in their interest. So it seems like there's a conflict of interest here. And one could say, well, is it in the national interest to go? No, it's in the interest of certain stockholders of the United Fruit Company. And it's against the interest of the people who will be drafted to serve or something like that. Okay, but now that's the wrong way of looking at it. because you see, the government, that turns out to be a domestic decision there, really. The question that the government should be asking is this. What will be the total cost to the United States as a whole of letting those plantations go? Next question. What will be the total cost to the United States as a whole? I know you get here into the giving a value to human life, but we have to do this all the time. What will be the total cost of going in there and trying to prevent that? And now, if the government uses the national interest as the criterion, it will go in or not go in depending upon which of those sums was greater. And that's simply a matter of adding, having the right information. But if you see, the government can, suppose it decides to go in. It can go in, intervene, and then tax the people who are the supposed beneficiaries, tax the whole thing away from you, and give it to the people who've had to pay the cost of the war. And by fighting, they're paying additional taxes. Or alternatively, the government could simply make the decision to tax all of its citizens and compensate the owners of the United Fruit Company. That decision is a domestic decision, and the president is not competent to decide what the national welfare requires here. But the national interest, and I hope I'm making this clear. You're looking at me. The national interest is the algebraic sum of all of the interests in the country. And, it's impossible to compute, but anybody who's in charge. And maybe they take a simple example. The president of the Missouri Synod, when he engages in foreign policy acts, is competent to judge the national interest of the Missouri Synod. He may judge it foolishly, stupidly, but he will not, he has no vested interest that will cause him to judge it foolishly. I'm not getting it across. Example. You got a balance? Little Missouri Synod, yeah.
Maybe I can ask
another
question.
Wait a minute, let me try one other thing. There is no parallel here. And that's important to grasp between domestic policy and foreign policy. And let's get away from that. The question, there are always two kinds of questions we have to resolve when it's a domestic issue. One is, what's the sensible, intelligent thing to do, the business of adding benefits and costs. And the other thing is, who's going to get what? How are we going to divide it up? Where are we going to inflict the burdens? And who will get the bulk of the benefits? But with foreign policy, that latter question need not arise. Suppose that you had a total dictator who didn't have to worry a bit about what the public thought. He would be in a perfect position to define the national interest. The trouble is, of course, that in a democracy, the citizens are always watching and listening, and the government would find it difficult to probably tax all of the citizens in order to compensate the owners of the United Fruit Company, and so the government would choose a more costly way than it ought to be choosing, simply because the less costly way is politically impossible at home. But that is one of the dangers of democratic foreign policy making. Again, can I just add, Bob is.
Yeah, it all seems to me to be fairly calculated and
let me speak to that very briefly, and then you. Okay, I'm afraid, Bob, that just the opposite problem. I think that the president is paying too much attention to the temperature of the country, that he is allowing redneck sentiment to determine our foreign policy. You know that if you ask the people whether they want to fight, they usually want to fight. The Woodrow Wilson's principles, you know, open decisions openly arrived at, and no secret negotiations and all that, has been demonic because it has given to the people, it was probably unfortunately necessary, the era of wholesale war, total war, necessitated wholesale conscription of men and resources, which required the enlisting of, you know, vast public sentiment behind the war. And that is a terribly dangerous thing to arouse, because we are, most of us, fiercely nationalistic. We've got this sense of pride. Nobody's going to kick the U.S. around. You know, those signs, remember the Pueblo.
Remember your name.
Yeah, well, you can go right back in our history. Remember Pearl Harbor. Dangerous, dangerous things. But their youth and their effectiveness testifies to something, that if you take the temperature of the nation and make foreign policy on the basis of that, I'm afraid you're going to have a far more bellicose foreign policy than we got now. I mean, after all, the majority of the people in this country, Bob, support President Nixon. They believe he was right to go into Cambodia. I think that the majority of the people would support anything he did. And it's not that they're really that hawkish, but I really fear that there are more hawks than doves in this world of sin. Not just in the United States, in other countries too. Because the citizens just, they have exaggerated notions of the power of their own government, just like, you know, if you're a Southern Methodist, you're sure they're going to beat the University of Texas, you know, and it's that kind of silly thing. He wanted to.
You were mentioning that about national interest, and use the National Food Company or whatever it was as an example. And obviously, one little old food company didn't make that much difference. One little old Standard Oil Company in Saudi Arabia isn't going to make that much difference. And it reminds me of a little kid with a hole in his pocket. Before you know it, he starts off with a bunch of change and he's lost it all along the way. You can, seems to me, with this type of thing, where do you draw the line?
Well, you're asking a practical question.
Yeah.
You're asking how should the government decide in concrete cases, and I don't have the information to answer you. I didn't say the government should never intervene to protect American property abroad. I didn't say that. I said if the government is faced with a decision, shall it intervene or not, the proper way to make the decision is to assess the total costs and the total benefits. Probably.
I agree. I know you didn't say that, but I mean, this is a problem that would arise out of it.
Well, sure. That's what I meant when I said that diplomacy is conducted in a game strategy situation. You sometimes a government will go in and it will accept costs in excess of the probable benefits in the belief that by doing so it can prevent another situation from arising farther on down the road.
This is evidently Cambodia, according to our information that we have available to us.
Well, I understood a little bit. Okay, yeah.
Was that a foreign policy decision? And the number one foreign policy maker, or was that a military decision as the commander-in-chief?
Now, wait a minute. Which, the Cambodian decision?
Yeah.
There is no difference that I can see.
Well, I mean, a man is the commander-in-chief of the armed services.
Oh yeah. Oh boy, yeah. This is not all right. I want to blast this one too. Yeah. The President of the United States is made Commander in Chief of this country not because he has some special mandate to protect the lives of soldiers overseas, but to assure civilian control of the military. The president's role as commander-in-chief simply reinforces his role as the architect of our foreign policy. And the president, again, I'm very disturbed about this, and some constitutional scholars have taken issue with him recently on this too, in his statement that he ordered the Cambodian thing because he's not only the maker of foreign policy, he's also commander-in-chief of the armed forces. That is not a valid argument. But I see it. There's another failure of reasoning power on the part of the president. You see, of course, no one wants to throw away men's lives, but if the president took seriously his role as commander-in-chief and he saw this, I've got to preserve the lives of these soldiers out here, then he would quickly withdraw them. All of them. Bring them home tomorrow.
Oh, yeah,
but he is the maker of foreign policy. No, I mean, I don't think anyone would contend, surely Nixon wouldn't contend, that he is, that the policy that we're now practicing in Southeast Asia is designed to save the lives of American troops. It's designed to minimize casualties of American troops subject to certain constraints, such as the achievement of certain policy goals. But let's not let the president convince us that he's a schizophrenic.
Are you sure that the president has the best information available?
No, I'm not sure.
Because, you know, I can't tell for sure, you know, I'm going to be in a new situation that, you know, whether or not he's using the best information available, I happen to know it might be right to tell you.
I don't know here. I don't know. Julie,
I kind of wonder if that is
your choice.
Or whether that's just the way it was handed down.
The problem is we can't know. We can guess. We do. We talk about it. We say he seems to be listening to the military men too much and not listening enough to the people in the State Department, but we don't know. We do know that to make foreign policy, a president has to listen to both. He's got to have men who are diplomats and men who are warriors, and he's the guy who puts it together. Remembering that war is simply the last recourse of diplomacy. I hope he remembers that. Ernie, you...
Would you venture a guess on the... Do you think our national interest or the reason for our standing on the side from Biafra?
The reason for our doing what?
Why didn't we get into this Biafra or the help out of those poor
I think we did not, because our national, it was not consistent with our national interest. Yeah. And I think we have not intervened in Rhodesia. Just, you know, we make a lot of noise, but we haven't really done much of anything, because it is not in our national interest to do so. We have not exercised sanctions against South Africa. Because, again, it is not in our national interest to do so. I don't want to give the impression that this government has abandoned the touchstone of national interest. Not only should national interest be the touchstone of foreign policy, it is in the overwhelming majority of instances. I'm afraid that Southeast Asia has developed a kind of dynamic of its own, and it's become a kind of a moral crusade for us, in which we are doing that always unintelligent thing of pretending that fixed, that sunk costs are relevant to decision making. You know, a smart decision maker knows that sunk costs are irrelevant. Now that's a hard doctrine, but that means that you cannot justify tomorrow's policy on the basis of the number of people who were killed yesterday. But I'm afraid we're doing that, and that is a failure of reasoning power. But I think that's a... Though I suspect that in when it comes to... When the issue of socialism or communism gets raised, then we are most likely to abandon the national interest or to lose clear sight of what we are trying to achieve and the limitations of our power. You and then Dave. Yeah.
Now, would you include in national interest just things which are, for the benefit of our citizens, or would you include things that our citizens would hold as long-range goals for the country that would not necessarily be what was the best for their benefit? Supposing, for instance, 80% of the citizens held as a long-range goal of the United States, one of them should be to help the underdeveloped countries to the point where they were not starving. Mm-hmm. Would that come?
Yes, I'm glad you raised that point, because the national interest includes, of course, the satisfaction of the aspirations and ideals of the citizens. And if the citizens earnestly and genuinely feel certain aspirations, a desire to help, then it is in the interest of the United States to help. Yeah.
I want to bring up one more point. I think most people in the United States would feel, in a long range, goal of most important would be for the whole world to be free from conflict, and also the citizens of the country to be free themselves. Which you may argue that for the benefit of the citizens of the United States too. But that's not necessarily what's for the most benefit of the United States citizens. I mean, the United States citizens by themselves, theoretically at least, would be better off if the whole world was working in the slavery system of the United States. I mean, most Christians would believe we were better off that way.
Well, we probably wouldn't.
In other words, when you say what's for the national benefit of citizens of the United States, and that's not the same as what you're saying for the national interest, would it be?
Well, yeah, it would be. You see, the thing is, in fact, it would not be in the best interest of the United States to have the whole world operating as our slaves. We couldn't control it. We're much better off controlling what we are capable of controlling. And the United States can't, you know, many people think, still believe, that if we had atom-bombed Russia, you know, right after World War II, We would have solved all our problems. We wouldn't have. We would not have. And we've got to get rid of that myth because it holds us captive again. We're always looking to the past and saying, oh, if we'd only clobbered them then when we could have, we wouldn't have these problems. If we had clobbered Russia in 1946, when we clearly had the power to do so, we would have had Russia on our hands. And what would we have done with it? What do you do with Russia when you own it? With 280 million people who don't like you. Well, Americans don't necessarily love each other either, but what did we do with Japan and Germany once we'd clobbered them? Well, we rebuilt them and gave them their independence because we can't control them.
I want to bring up one more question. If 90% of the citizens of the country get money, we have a long-range goal, which doesn't, I'm not talking about a specific war or anything, but it's a long-range goal for a country to believe in something which wasn't for their maximum benefit, then that would be in there for the national interest, even though 90% of the people believe.
Now, wait a minute. If 90% of the people strongly want something that isn't in their interest, then it's in their interest.
No, it's not. People don't necessarily want the thing that's for their most benefit.
Well, maybe we're quarreling here, maybe just about words. When I say national interest and benefit of the citizen, I'm not thinking of narrow material benefit. I think that Americans want and feel satisfaction in achieving all sorts of ideals, that there are humanitarian impulses that are very powerful that flow through our society, which have to be given scope for expression. And if a government doesn't give its citizens scope for expressing these ideals, it is not promoting the national welfare. Don't read into benefit or interest when I use the term anything greedy or selfish or narrow, necessarily.
No, I don't. But what you want is much for your most benefit, not necessarily the same thing. 90% of people get told it's lottery and goal, something which is not for their
you mean because
of... They're not the same thing. A lot of the times people don't hold it's lottery and goal, something deeper than long-term.
Okay, you mean there's sort of a failure of analysis here. The people think it would be good for them, and in fact, if they got it, it would be bad for them?
Good, because they're not interested only in their own benefit, too. They think it would be good, even if it's not as much for their benefit as something else, just because they don't believe they should follow what's for their most greatest benefit. That's a moral position that some people hold. So it's possible to hold it all what's not for your own greatest benefit.
Right after World War II, it was a great thing. Bring boys home.
Yeah.
They brought them home and the powerful nation of the earth and the confusion.
Yeah.
The biggest deal of how it ever was.
Well, I'm not sure the communists told us. I found a lot of good Republicans who wanted to bring the boys home. Yeah. Well, I think it is certainly true the people can and do want things, think they want things that just have bad consequences. Is that what you're talking about?
Well, no, I'm thinking that all of the goals more than in specific actions. I mean, the goal of the people who are doing what their long-range goals are. I wouldn't apply it to a specific war. I mean, people may want the government not to fight a specific war for some reason, international issues. But I'm talking about long-range goals, like something like freedom for the whole world or something like that.
Maybe here's an example, I don't know if this is what he means, but you take the example of Guatemala in 54. Now, if it had been in our national interest to, you know, let democracy reign, whatever that is, we could have let our bands, you know, have this land reform and take over the United Fruit Company's land. So we would have let democracy go on. Now, I think that it's one of the things that, you know, most people in the United States want around the world, democracy. But United Fruit Company benefits because they make a lot more profit, and we pay less for bananas if we, as we did, if we overthrew them. See, we get our bananas less and the companies benefit.
Mm-hmm.
But for a long-range goal,
well,
aren't we assuming again that the people are deciding the national interest? Didn't you say that the president is about the only one that's really qualified?
Well, I don't know what reason. I'm still puzzled here about what the, maybe I don't know, against someone else. Maybe I don't understand the thrust of this argument, and maybe we could pursue it privately unless somebody else wants to.
Yeah.
Okay. All right, Dave.
I'm going to try and make it, but I couldn't be making it last. And I'm wondering, you said last and almost answered it, but didn't you give a kind of a instant agency of what our proposed national interest are?
No. No.
I gave a
sort of a QRB.
I mean, it came out like what you're saying is,
yeah,
that what citizens want is a national interest.
No, what the citizens think they want must contribute to any assessment of the national interest, because it is in the national interest that the citizens have the feeling they're getting what they want. But that's not the only thing to take into account. A person who knows more may say, well, I know they want this, but they don't know the cost of getting it, and therefore I'm not going to get it for them. I'm very much opposed, I say this, to trying to determine the national interest by going out and taking polls regularly. That's not the way to determine the national interest.
No, but I mean, I was thinking that maybe there is a supposed national interest. Number one, we want a freedom of all people.
That can never be. You can never define the national interest in terms of specific goals. Never do that. The national interest, maybe this helps. The national interest ain't anything. Maybe a better way to put it is, let's ask, what is in the national interest? That's what I'm after. I want the government always to ask, what is in the national interest? In other words, the government comes to a decision situation, it should ask, which of these two possible decisions will more likely better promote in the interests of this nation as a whole. You know, now there's no thing out there called the national interest, which we secure. Now we got it. We got the national interest. It isn't anything. The national interest is a touchstone for decisions. That's all. Juliana.
I want to know if you said, someone up here is saying, did you say that the president is the only person competent to decide what the national interest is in the nation? Did you say that?
Did I? I'm asking, did I say that? I don't know. Did I? The question is, did I say it? I said it.
The only person in a position.
Yeah.
Make that.
Yeah, in a position, right? Yeah. Yeah, he is in. He's the person in the best position. Well, how competent? He is. Look, if he is more competent than anyone else, then he's competent. His office as president qualifies him in a way that no one else seems qualified.
What if he is an incompetent person?
That's a tragedy.
Yeah, I mean, all I'm trying to say is that being in that office, if one, you're saying, a position to best decide national interest, it does not mean that the man in that office will necessarily know it, right?
I said that I thought Nixon was losing sight of the national interest and wasn't thinking about it a lot these days. What I really meant to assert when I was talking about that is that there is no reason why the president is incompetent to decide what is in the national interest, whereas there are reasons why the president is and should be held incompetent to decide what is in the domestic interest. That is to say, there is no reason why the president is disqualified from deciding on his own, finally, what our foreign policy shall be. While there are reasons for holding that the president is incompetent to decide on his own, without the democratic process, what shall be done with respect to domestic questions. And the reason for that difference is that domestic questions always involve the over catering to certain interest groups and catering less to other interest groups. And those people who are not being not particularly well represented by that president should always remain in opposition. They should be suspicious of it.
But the president himself seems to have personality difficulties or have all kinds of problems that may disqualify him for deciding the national interest, right?
Yeah, sure.
Is he paranoid?
He could be.
All kinds of things.
Right. Could be.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I'd like to see the debate and morality, because I feel the only justification, you know, given the present political situation, for using, for judging the worth of a person's life, seen in Vietnam, the only justification for us losing men there is to say we'll lose less by doing this than letting it go. We'll lose less by fighting now.
Mm-hmm.
And in my analysis, we won't lose less if we let it go. So therefore, it's an immoral war.
Okay.
We're
now
allowing the killing to go on.
Yeah. All right. Let me see if I can get your premises out in the open. You're assigning an infinite value to human life and no value to anything else. No value to. In other words, is that right? Suppose the government is faced. I want to have a very simple example. Suppose the government is faced with these choices: sacrifice 10,000 lives, or accept a 40% reduction in the wealth of Americans. Now, you have no doubt what the moral decision would be. Well, I do. I don't know what the moral decision would be. It seems to me that...
Well, I think the Americans could very well afford it.
Well, okay, yeah, all right, yeah.
Yes,
I agree with you, Jerry, so that weakens my example, but the... let's suppose it's a 40% reduction in our freedom to travel, worship, and speak. Now, would you still make the same judgment that morality calls for accepting that rather than losing lives? Aren't there any things worth dying for?
Well, I
the problem you get into, Jerry, is that there are some things, even some very material things, whose ownership prolongs and preserves life. Besides enhancing life, I believe that the quality and intensity of life is important too. That death is not the greatest of evils. At least death is certainly not the sole evil.
Death is certain.
Yeah.
Are you talking about dying for or killing for?
What?
Are you talking about dying for or killing for?
Well. Sure, but
to die for something is one thing, but to kill something.
All right, but aren't there things worth killing for? Yeah, I know, but I mean, I'll take a stacked example. So a madman bursts into my house and says, I'm going to kill your whole family. And I kill him. There's something worth killing for. Or he bursts into my house and he says, I'm going to just beat up your whole family. And I kill him. Or he bursts in and says, I'm going to take all your property. Do I kill him? He says, I'm going to take your silverware. I know I wouldn't kill him. But
you're dealing, Paul, with the thing I think that's very important. Because I think that if you're going to deal in these realms with what is worth killing for, then that is a toughness. Because, you see, it seems to me some people would kill over what another person would feel was trivial.
Yeah,
and
sure.
This I can't help coming back to this, in our national interest, etc., and it applies so much to what we're doing at home. Really, what do we really value? What are we really after as an ultimate goal as far as our own personal lives are concerned? And does that carry over to a country? And I think that what we're experiencing right now is a tremendous wrestling match within the country as to really what we hold dear. While one person would kill for a piece of property, the next person would say, you can have everything that I've got.
Mm-hmm.
I wouldn't kill to spend anything that I have, you see. And the polarization between this and carries over so much into our foreign policy. If you don't want to drag morals into it, I guess that's your prerogative. That is a tough one, you see. But really, what do we really hold dear to ourselves? What are we willing to kill for?
Yeah.
And you've got a tremendous diversification within the country right now and the internal struggle that we're going through.
Well, morals are important. I don't want to be misunderstood on this. There's nothing more important than morals, in a sense. But I don't want to drag morality into this because I think it does only harm. You may feel that the reason so many Americans support the Southeast Asian war is because they're willing to kill to preserve their property. But even if that were true, they don't think so. I mean, they don't think that's the reason. Americans believe, maybe they have deluded themselves into believing, but I think I'm quite certain that the majority of Americans believe that they are fighting this war for the sake of some human value beyond their own wealth. And so to introduce morality into it, it is always dangerous to introduce morality into an argument. Because, not because people shouldn't be moral, not because morality doesn't determine behavior, because when you introduce morality, you are saying, I'm righteous, and you're a sinner, and that ends discussion. It is so much better to keep the argument on the level of what's the more intelligent thing to do right now.
But you keep it on the more intelligent thing to do, and forget about the morality. We'll just leave it as the more intelligent thing to do. When you leave it at that level, and I'm still afraid that even dealing with it on that level, that you're going to rip this country apart. Isn't that the because I think that, you know, even the more intelligent thing to do, because people make value judgments as to what is the more intelligent thing to do. If you want to deal on that level, that's fine. I don't know how you separate morality from it, but, and I don't like the thing of, you know, you are a sinner and I am not. I can't deal in that realm. I can't handle that. But what I'm saying is that the internal conflict at this point, as far as value, as to what is national interest, that there are some people that are so committed to the way that they think on both sides of it that the internal struggle is going to be much more efficient than the external threat. mean to drag it off the subject, but that seems to me to be crucial at this point in discussing, because that comes right back to our internal
Well, I have found that when I talk against our present policy in Southeast Asia with people, I mean, really pushing, not doing what I'm trying to do tonight, which is rise above it a little bit, I make progress by talking about the costs of the war and the probable benefits. And the probable benefits can be made to seem small, because I think they are small. And the costs can be made to seem large. They are large. And I don't find people turning me off. They don't call me a communist or something else. They listen. And if we can keep the discussion on this level, I think we will minimize the probability of conflagration, domestic violence.
That might be a point well taken, maybe, but then we have to move away from the point of trying to discuss personal feelings about the situation and get back to that thing which most Americans understand all too well, and dollars and cents. I mean, baby, you're not going to cost it. It's going to cost you more money going over there and killing all those Greeks.
Right, Bob. And you know, there's nothing immoral about it. You know, that can be a highly moral way of proceeding. It can be extremely moral to proceed on the assumption that all men are immoral. You know? Because if by doing that you can preserve order and peace, you have accomplished a good thing.
Maybe you didn't let enough ancestors change costs, and they come up and say that it seems that 90% of the people that agree with the president have these costs up and say, maybe this is right. Then we criticize them and we say their reasoning is faulty.
Yeah, well, you don't just tell somebody his reasoning is faulty. You try to show him where his reasoning is faulty, why it's faulty, what he's not taking into account, or so on. No, it does. To tell somebody you're stupid also isn't a very effective way of conducting a debate. You would put it in a subtle way. You say, you didn't add this column correctly, I believe.
Hey, Paul, I disagree with some of what is going on here, because I think it goes right back to what you were saying at the beginning. You say that the moral, you know, and it's not very strong, the moral, and I think the moral is in here. But the minute we start in this, I think, you know, my morals, you're right back to the thing that only the president is, you can't intelligently criticize it on that point. All you can criticize is the morals. And I can criticize your morals as well as you can criticize mine and the president. And it's basically, I, you've got a whole bunch of eyes around here. But it goes back to the point that Paul, one of the points that only the president is in a position to have all this information. And it doesn't rule out more.
I respect that, I really do. And that's why I was very careful to use the word I instead of we. Because it's only my personal feeling on the situation. And if you want to come right down to it, I can't be made to do anything that I don't want to do, you see, except die. You can make me do that. But this is a position that a lot of people in this country are beginning to take, is the I position. And that is a moral position. You know, I hold the responsibility to a power much greater than the power that we in this country. That is I. You see, and I will hold true to that responsibility. And so how do I abduct myself from that moral deficit?
Don't you also have a responsibility to me?
Certainly do.
And everybody?
I have a responsibility, and that's what I try to live up to, but I have to live it the way that I feel that I have to live it.
But you also have to, there's a bigger place, too.
Oh,
I mean, there's the bigger, but you aren't just a moral being, you're a thinking being. And suddenly, all of a sudden, if you start as the only reason that you start is the moral, what about the rest of you?
You get your morals through the thinking.
Yeah, I know. But it came back to this, if you want to fight on a moral basis where you disagree with what Paul has said, And but you're supposed to be an intelligent person, moral, sure.
I don't think the two of you really have a quarrel. I think Bob is asserting that an individual finally in these troublous times is going to have to decide where he stands and stand. The times have grown dangerous. And you are saying, what he's not denying, be sure that you're listening and thinking, and that when you take a stand, it isn't unalterable and saying, well, I feel this way, and so here I stand forever, and I'll never change my mind. That's what you're saying. You're saying be thinking all the time and always reevaluating the position that you take on a moral basis. And I Bob would buy that.
But, you know, when you're saying that you know, okay, it's more moral to hear that, you know, that man is immoral.
You're trying to say that we live in a society where we're responsible to some degree to our neighbor?
Well, the basic point that I started in on was Paul's referring to Bob on saying, you know, start with man is immoral because dollars counts more than moral. It's basically what, you know, this came through.
He was making a kind of a resigned statement. You know, maybe that's the way Americans are, and so if they are that way, we better deal with them that way. And I agree, if that's the way they are, let's deal with them that way. You know, if a guy responds, if I want a guy to do something for me, and it's urgent that he do it for me, and the only thing he responds to is a dollar, I'm going to give him a dollar. And I'm not going to say, but he should have done it for love. If it's urgent that he get it done, and if it's, you know, if it's a great, it's a great
it's
good that I want to
do. I think it more fits into this that, only the president is in the position to have that information. And as long as we're going to treat that as moral, we're not doing anything. But I don't think it's just dollars that hit people.
Okay. Yeah, well, I don't think it's just dollars.
There are some people that you can speak on an economic level, some on a moral level, some on a gut level.
She was saying there's no point in calling the president immoral.
Okay,
and
right.
That I do agree.
Well,
the president may be, any president may be highly immoral, and he may even be a madman. I would rather that he is immoral than a madman. But I've got to hope he's neither. And I'm afraid, we've talked about this, I find the most useful assumption to make is the president is not mad. He is rational. Because if I assume he isn't, I'm lost. I'm utterly lost.
Are you talking us into a complacency?
No.
That's what I'm saying.
Maybe if you're going to be grateful, you may as well lay back and enjoy it.
I criticize three arguments the president's been using. Because I think I do have the intelligence to criticize those. And I would urge everyone else, if he finds this criticism valid, to join in it. and to call the president to account here. I don't think I'm constant complacency, but when I say, let's call the president to account, I'm assuming he's rational, and that he can be made to see, my gosh, yeah, that isn't consistent. I am doing a foolish thing here. Certainly, in many ways, he has. I mean, President Nixon's cunning is well known. He's a very smart man, and he is. I know it's painful for Democrats to admit. I have strong personal distaste in there.
Well, it depends on how much you follow all the inconsistencies that just people are as far as I'm concerned.
Some inconsistencies are part of the game. I just don't worry about the credibility gap thing when it comes to foreign policy. I expect the president to bamboozle me all the time, tell me lies. I expect it. I would do it if I were president. I would lie to people.
Why? What you're doing is...
Because some lies, I would try to minimize. I usually try to keep my mouth shut. But if a question comes up, you know, if someone asks me, you know, if I say, I have troops poised to go across the Bungo Bungo River tomorrow at 8 o'clock, and someone says, do we have any troops around the Bungo Bungo River? I would say, no.
Yeah, well, but those are technical.
Well, all right, but suppose somebody asked me now, is the United States willing to settle for a certain kind of a coalition government in Saigon? And I know we are, but I'm hoping we can get better. And I'll say, never. Because if I tell the people, I tell the enemy. You can't, a trade union leader can't go into the bargaining sessions and say, well, here's what we're starting out with, fellas, but here's what we'll be willing to accept. No, because he'd be back, then bargaining would start there and he'd go back further.
There's a good book on that, isn't there? The theme of that nation square. I
don't know. I don't know.
But you mentioned in the world, you kind of one guy in poker game, and it's kind of like you're going to tell somebody else what's in your hand because of this.
Yeah.
The United States is interested in small countries because we really want to help those poor, wretched people overcome their poverty, raise their economic level so that they're not in a state of starvation? Or are we in there because we want their raw material so that we can keep on being well educated and moving, Mr. President? How do you answer that?
Oh, I would answer the first. And I know I was lying in my teeth.
And you expect, you know, you expect me to have faith.
But I wouldn't think it was the second one either, by the way.
Yeah.
I mean, I wouldn't, I don't, I'm certain Nixon doesn't. I'm certain Nixon does not think that we are in there to preserve American raw materials.
Okay, is that, you know, we know that you agree with that, but we also know that you're lying by the inconsistency of your foreign policy. We know it. And besides that, I don't know any of those kids who want to grow up to be like President Nixon. So, you know, how do you expect this kind of support to come from that?
Well, you, all right, there's nothing worse than dumb lying. No, I'm sorry I ever got into this. I'm not urging the president to run around and tell lies. I'm saying he's going to deceive us. As long as the nation is engaged in dangerous foreign policy actions, we are going to be deceived. Primarily, I hope, by simply not gaining access to information. It's always bad when the president has to answer a direct question and lie, because he tends to get found out, and then it does destroy his credibility, and that is bad. And it makes it more difficult to lie the next time. But anyway, you just do have to conceal things from your enemies. That's all there is to it. You can't tell the people and keep the enemy in the dark. We're in a bad world. It's not a good world.
And you get an overwhelming recommendation of what should be done, and even the top scholars in the country our military knew no better. Our intelligence reports tell us things that, you don't have a chance at. But where is the confidence supposed to come? You know, is it a king that we have or what?
Bob, I am losing confidence. You know, I expected Nixon to have us pretty well out of Vietnam within a year of the time that he was inaugurated. I was surprised that he didn't get us out, because some of the things that he said between the time of his election and the time of his inauguration, some of the things he said in the first month or two indicated that he had a pretty clear grasp of the way foreign policy is conducted in this sinful world. He was sounding like Hans Morgenthau and George Kennan. I don't know what happened, and it looks to me as if he's gotten bamboozled by the same kind of megalomania that kept trapped Lyndon Johnson. And these things, the notion that we can't lose, we must not be humiliated, we must not have a defeat. And not seeing that you can take a defeat and call it a victory. And the other thing is that he's going back to this talk about freedom and democracy. Do you remember in the first few months of his administration, he was talking about America pulling back, realizing we had limited powers, we couldn't do everything in the world, limited objectives and all that. And I said, here we go. What has happened to him? I am losing confidence in the man rapidly. I wonder if there's something that happens to men when they become president. That's possible. There's a real frightening possibility. There are accounts, damaging, very, very, very frightening accounts of how information gets contaminated before it gets up to the president. It makes one wonder whether we should have a president. The presidency is probably the second worst institution in the country. The only worst one would be not having a president.
The reason I want to make it clear, but I would like very much to have confidence in Johnson. I'm not trying to rip and tear that and tear the country down. I want to have confidence in him. I really do. I read books like The Invisible Government and about the CIA and how they influence foreign policy, and that really it's questionable whether or not the president really makes foreign policy or whether the CIA is making. I do want to have confidence in government, I really do. And I just like for them to own up to their end of the deal.
But if they're not in charge, they can't own up to it.
No, that's right. That's the big question. Yeah. Is that really the government that you see up there, the figurehead?
Mm-hmm. Well,
when it comes to the question of who's going to be in charge, then we have the problem in a political campaign, whether it's presidential or senatorial or what have you, what should be debated. If we take your thesis that there are aspects which the American citizen cannot intelligently criticize because he doesn't have the information, that will also be true about the person who is seeking the position where he will have the resources. Now, I take it by definition, this cannot be debated since he does not have the facts upon which to base any issue. He is limited to the second part of your presentation in terms of talking about the reasoning power, the logic, the illogic, things of that nature. I'm wondering how controversial a thesis you've actually presented here tonight. I mean, we're all going to agree, aren't we, that if you don't have the facts, you can't criticize. You shouldn't.
I hope.
It ruins a lot of conversations. And as far as criticism of the Vietnam War, to my mind, at least what I read in the criticism of the Vietnam War, is not tactics. It's not a question of cost-benefit analysis of the Cambodian situation. Nixon invited criticism of that by the kind of defense he made of it, in terms of talking about costs and benefits and what we had to do to protect troops here and so forth and so on, with his maps and charts and diagrams. He invited criticism of that. Perhaps he shouldn't have done that. Perhaps all he should have said, I made the decision, I can't tell you people, you know, why I did, because this is the kind of information the president can't share with people. And he shouldn't have gone into any of the statistics, knowing that he can't tell us the complete picture. But how controversial is it? what the criticism of the Vietnam War is, the kinds of things that you yourself presented here tonight, the two to three flaws in the logic that you presented. And not only because Nixon has said things that we criticize, but there are other things that people say we should be advancing that he is not advancing. Now, it's not just a question of criticizing his logic, it's a question of advancing their own. And in that area, I think you agree that that should be a part of the political campaign for the presidency. It should be a part of every senatorial race. The Senate does have a responsibility, which they are, I think, belatedly recognizing in that area. So what really is controversial about the position that you have put forward here tonight?
Nothing that I can see.
You couldn't see you're criticizing yourself, I'm sure of that, but I mean, apart from that.
No, I don't
think
there's anything.
You know, I think it came out in kind of a controversial way. I think many of us have reacted to it. You presented something rather shocking here tonight, that, you know, the American citizens shouldn't criticize foreign policy. But that was the first part, not the second part. And it's the second part where the action is.
However, though, you have a value judgment between married men who will have information. Men like Holder, for example. Now, you have to make a decision on the basis of the man and the past record and all, and I think here we have to make a decision.
I think it's important to note that Fulbright has usually abstained. I haven't read everything he's written, of course, but he's usually abstained from technical cost-benefit kind of criticism. He has gone back and raised sort of philosophical questions of how does a nation make foreign policy? And those are questions that senators and citizens can legitimately raise. And here Fulbright has performed an immense service for us. And it really infuriates me to see the way he's treated by people who just are unwilling or incapable of understanding what he's saying.
Years ago, he was on the trail here and was unheeded.
Yeah, well, he's still largely unheeded. You know, there's a small group that flocked to his banner, and many of whom I think also didn't understand what he was saying. They just saw in him an opponent of the Vietnam War, and he fell in behind him. And there's a much larger number, apparently, that now condemns him. He's out of it. He's a traitor. He's called in some Arkansas newspapers from the Dallas Morning News. So that he's not listening to. And here is a voice of reason. I'm not saying that everything Fulbright says is correct, but Fulbright certainly demonstrates a grasp of some fundamental principles that I don't think are controversial at all. They certainly are controversial among scholars about the way in which a nation has to conduct foreign policy. And it's not a child's game. That's what Fulbright is saying.
Paul, would you agree or disagree that there might be a place for the historian to criticize the government's foreign policy, not on the basis of individual facts and where truths are and where individual specific weaknesses are, but on the past trend, the past tendency in the history of the world?
Oh, you mean here? I don't think so, because I got it. Well, I don't know. A guy that doesn't know anything about history is going to be a botch. But a guy who thinks that he can use history to make decisions is also going to be a botch. It's very dangerous to appeal to history to make decisions. But I think decisions should be made with as much knowledge of history as you can acquire. I don't know if do those positions seem inconsistent? History provides warnings. History suggests things, reasons why things don't work. History suggests innumerable pitfalls. But history never tells you what to do in this new situation by suggesting a lot of things that shouldn't be done if you're narrowly
viewed. There never are analogous situations that come up against history. Everything is new.
Well, I'm assuming that if one does come up, you won't know for sure until it's passed. No, sir. No. Look. Maybe by reading history, you can eliminate 22 choices and get it down to 3. Okay? That's good. That's a tremendous job for history to accomplish. There's an awful lot of inanity floating around in foreign policy discussions. And just a little reading of, say, George Kennan's paperback book on the history of American diplomacy in 1900 and 1950 exploded. Get rid of this stuff. Boy, the whole level of foreign policy discussion in this country would climb 352% if a lot of people would just read that little book on American diplomatic history. But I don't think that's enough. Yeah, Kevin certainly doesn't claim that's enough to enable you to make the decisions today. But it helped.
I don't know that Humphrey could have done it any better. He may say he can, but I think he's done quite a good job. I mean, we go back to Kennedy and the Bay of Pigs, and we go back to Eisenhower and the Francis Gary Powers, and then they go back. And they all made big mistakes, and they all told lies. And it's just a human error here along the line. A foreign policy.
Well, it isn't the mistakes. I mean, it isn't the tactical mistakes that bother me so much as the grand strategic errors that I think the danger committed. No, and I'm not picking on Nixon and Johnson exclusively. I really, the only president in this century in whom I really have confidence as the architect of American foreign policy, the only one was Harry Truman. Because I think he was the only one who really understood what it was all about. The rest of them were, for the most part, dangerously naive. Woodrow Wilson and Franklin D. Roosevelt are two eminent examples. Extraordinary naivete in the area of foreign policy. Little old Harry Truman, simple man, perhaps because he was simple, you know. He realized he didn't know much, so he was learning all the time, learning. And he had this kind of salty, realistic, gutsy approach to things, and a tremendous respect for history. Harry Truman. Well, it's time to quit.
Well, you can meet him there in the agrarian farmer. And boy, I knew they weren't. I was there.
Yes, but that doesn't, the important thing is that he did not send American troops in to pull Chiang Kai-shek's chestnuts out of the fire. Well, yeah. But he lived through all the China lobby ruckus and kept us from doing all sorts of foolish things that people like Nolan were urging. Yeah. Well, it was, I'm afraid it was too late from the beginning. Chiang Kai-shek just never, he was never in the cards. He never could unify China. Relatively speaking, really.